Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, premium bonds. How much do you really need to hold to win big? Simon calls on all political parties to sort out the tax mess that we find ourselves in. Drivers are increasingly concerned about second-hand EVs, but are they right? And finally, King Charles banknotes are out. But what are the serial numbers that you really want? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I've spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.
But first, more than 22 million of us hold premium bonds in the hope of one day winning big. But how much do you have to own to land a £1 million jackpot? Well, contrary to common myth, you don't actually need to hold the maximum holding of £50,000. Money Mail analysed some data. And what, Lee Boyce, did they find? I imagine having £50,000, though, is helpful. No?
I'm just to point out here, this was actually a This Is Money investigation.
Mate,
analysis.
It was, then I think you need to go back into this article and have a word.
It was published in the newspaper, that's why.
I'm so sorry.
It's all right. It was written by Helen Alsace.
Would you like me to go over and do that again for the benefit of our listener? All right, fine.
It's
okay.
Fine. No, it's absolutely fine.
Then Lee, carry on.
It's absolutely fine. It was just a piece that we were writing for the website, and then, as is these days, sometimes...
They stole it. Is that what you're saying, then?
It's not stolen. No, it just went to a wider audience by going in the newspaper. This is a really interesting one, I think. And actually, there is a big myth around having, you know, looking at who wins the prizes, that having £50,000, only those with £50,000 really win the £1 million jackpot. So there's two £1 million jackpots every month. And essentially, every £1 bond that is in the draw has an equal chance of winning. But if you've got 50,000 of them, as opposed to £100 worth, obviously, you know, your odds are much shorter. They're still very, very long of scooping the prize, but you're going to have more of a chance of being able to win one of these £1 million prizes. Now, we went back over the last 100 draws. We went back over the last 50 draws. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to go back to the pandemic boom. And actually 50 draws ago was May 2020, which is when the first draw, really, when lots of people have pumped in cash from the pandemic into premium bonds. Remember, there was that mad few months where there was so much money pouring into premium bonds. The thing is with premium bonds is that I'm a big fan of them, but they should, they're definitely one of those things that people put all their eggs into one basket. So they feel like, you know, let's say you've got £5,000 worth of savings. Some people will just go, I'm going to put it all in the premium bonds, which is quite possibly not the right strategy. I always think it's one of those things that should be part of your portfolio, potentially, but you know, you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket because there's no guarantee that you're going to win prizes every month. And a case in point of that is I haven't won a premium bonds prize, I think, for about 2 years. I don't have a sort of insignificant sum of money in them. And actually it's got to the point where I'm kind of questioning whether I should still be in it or not. The underlying rate is 4.4%, which is a kind of barometer that they put out there as to what the average sort of return should be. But of course you could go way higher than that, and you could also have a 0% return like me. So going back over these 50 draws, we kind of crunched what the average holding has been of the £1 million winners, and the sum that has spat out is £38,779. So again, this myth had a bit of legs this week because there was a premium bonds draw on Monday and both of the winners had £50,000 in it. So you can see why people go, you've got to have £50,000 in order to win that six-figure sum. Also looking at the kind of last 50 draws, the 100 newly made millionaires, 38 out of the 100 had the maximum £50,000. That means that 62 people didn't have the maximum amount in premium bonds. And you only have to go back and look over the draws, even these last 50 draws. Someone won £1 million with £1,001. I love that odd £1 that was in it. And that was in Devon, in August, the winner in Devon in August 2021. Going back further than that, there's been a £1 million jackpot since 1994. And roughly since 2009, there's been two £1 million jackpots, other than occasional special draws where there's been more than one, more than two prizes of £1 million. But someone actually won the £1 million with £17 in July 2004. They were from East London. And
Wow.
imagine that, 17 quid, and you've won £1 million. And unlike the lottery, which is it's kind of hybrid product, isn't it? We kind of sometimes find it hard to describe, but it's kind of like playing the lottery, but being able to get your stake back is what it's like. So £17 to £1 million is probably the most wild example that you can go back and look at this. And then we actually, just to go really deep dive, Helen Crane, our savings reporter, went really, really deep into this and crunched all the figures for £100,000 prizes and £50,000 prizes too, because NS&I have really ramped up the number of £100,000 prizes and £50,000 prizes in the last sort of year and a half. There's been 1,639 winners of £100,000 over the last 50 draws, and the average holding was £38,745. And of these, 47% had the maximum 50K in their account. And then of the 3,270 £50,000 prize winners, the typical sum held is £38,741, with 48% having the maximum holding. So it's quite similar across the board, across all of those prizes. 38,000 seems to be the magic number. But again, there's loads of examples of people that have won with smaller amounts than that, including in this draw. I mean, someone from West Yorkshire won £100,000 this week with £300 of premium bonds, and they were only purchased 7 months ago. And
Wow.
that's what kind of entices us in. That's what kind of keeps people kind of putting their money into premium bonds and enjoy that kind of, monthly draw that comes up. But there's no guarantee that you're ever going to win those prizes, as we full well know. But and the popularity of premium bonds is showing no signs of letting up, Georgie. I mean, there's 44% boom in the amount that's in premium bonds from people in the last 4 years. And there's 124 billion eligible numbers for this draw. That's up from 86.1 billion in March 2020. So there's a lot more people having money in NS&I. There's a lot more bigger prizes now than there was 4 years ago. So that's playing in people's minds, and is a reason that people are going for it. The average premium bond holder has £5,250. So well below the 50K level. I think at the last count, there's roughly about a million, probably a little bit more than that now, of people that have the maximum 50K in premium bonds.
Like, forgive my aging memory, but weren't there at one stage some banks that tried, or building societies that tried this sort of savings sort of, I don't want to say gimmick. It's not a gimmick, but oh, sort of is.
Well, I think
But
when it's not
how
through
did that
banks.
take off? Is it, why do we not see it more in the sort of private
I
sector,
think
as it were, of banks?
when you're talking about banks, I think it is a bit gimmicky, really. I think what people want from their bank is just a solid rate of return. There's already premium bonds. Premium bonds already exist. They're from NS&I. They're a product that have been around for almost 70 years. People trust them, they're treasury backed. All of those things, I think people just naturally go, and £50,000 is a pretty sizable limit for most people in this country. I mean, basically, listeners to this podcast, the likelihood is one in two listeners probably have premium bonds. It might even be higher than that, given that we talk about money and we've got a more skewed audience, people that are interested in money. But I think with the banks, it hasn't really taken off anywhere near in the same way, because again, the prizes aren't as juicy as what's being offered here. I mean, £1 million, you say £1 million, that's still a significant sum for 99.99% of people. No bank has ever offered those kind of prizes. If you had a bank saying, here we go, we've got £1 million prize every month, they might have more of a shot at getting people in and doing it. But it was a piece of research this week, Georgie, talking about the Consumer Duty, which is rules that are meant to come in for banks to be As part of that, banks should be offering fairer rates and fairer savings rates. Well, they've done absolutely nothing to do that. And we had this analysis of the five biggest banks. They pay an average of 1.69% on £10,000. You know, that is the five biggest banks. That is not good enough.
No.
Not in a time when we're still at
No.
plus 5% rates. Then you can see why people probably go, if they want to save, they might go, do you know what? In it to win it mentality, isn't there, with the premium bonds? You think, let's do it. And then, yeah, they've launched over the years, Georgie. I haven't got to hand all the ones. I know
No.
Halifax did it. But I just don't think it's kicked off in the same way. I think the prize has typically been 10 grand. And I'm not
The fact
saying
we
10
can't
grand,
remember,
but
Lee, is
well,
sort of
it's
quite
actually that, yeah.
Well, I've got it in front of me here now, right? So the Halifax Savings Prize Draw says every month we give 1,603 customers the great news that they're a winner in the Savers Prize Draw. Halifax Marketing Department, please send your checks to Simon Lambert. So basically, they said every month we give away three prizes of £100,000, 100 prizes of £1,000, and 1,500 prizes of £100. Quick to register, you just need to do it once. So if you're saving £5,000 or more in a qualifying account you're entered, you've got to have that balance in there for the whole calendar month to be eligible for the next month's prize draw. It could be made up of your savings in all your qualifying accounts. So Halifax savings accounts, cash ISAs, accounts for kids don't count. But then what are you giving up? Because Halifax is not necessarily offering the best savings rates, is it? And you're probably not going to win. There's another interesting one, which is CHIP. Now, CHIP basically has one of the best cash ISAs out there that you can get, and it's got a really good easy access account. The easy access account and the cash ISA, I believe, both track the base rate. The cash ISA is great. It's flexible, so you can take money in and out, pays a top rate. You have to manage it on the app. The easy access account, I think, pays something like 4.84%, which is like, it's not the best, but it's pretty good. It's a good app and so on. Or you could go for the prize savings account, which instead of earning interest on your deposits, they count towards entries in a monthly prize draw. So there's a share of £62,500 in prizes. So there's a £50,000 prize, followed by a £10,000 prize, and then 250 additional prizes every month. But again, what are you giving up to do that? Well, you're giving up a really quite good savings rate in the hope that you might win. I mean, you could maybe say the same about the premium bonds, but I don't know. They're not directly relatable, I don't think.
So in some Lee, I think you said it at the start. Let's go back to whether there's better out there. It really depends on, I mean, who you are, how much you've got, and using premium bonds as a part of something. I know you're not a financial advisor, but look, you like you say, you've not got anything in the last 2 years, did you say? My other
Yeah.
half is constantly like, I've just won £400. I got 50. I was so proud.
50 grand.
No
Oh, 50
quid.
quid. Oh, God.
See what fun you can have with premium bonds, you know?
No, I think at the heart of it, actually, you know, is I treat it as a little bit of fun. Like, you know, money isn't fun in general, and you having that kind of little monthly sort of thought of, oh, I wonder if I've won big this month, is what keeps people in it. But, you know, as you say, going right back to the start of this, it shouldn't be the be all and end all of your portfolio. You know, it needs to be blended with however else you save, you know, having your emergency savings account somewhere else, having investments, making sure that you're, you know, paying into your pension, all that kind of thing needs to factor into whether or not you should be investing into premium bonds. And I kind of wrote something about this recently that for ch lots of people opt for premium bonds for children, you know, because they can make quite a good gift, for example. Personally, I don't save into premium bonds for my children. I invest for them because I think in the long term, I've got an 18-year sort of stretch of time to be able to invest for my children. So I've picked and opted to do that. But it's all down to individual circumstances, isn't it? However you want to play it, you know, and there's more than 1 million people, or around about 1 million people that have £50,000 maxed out in their premium bonds. You'd like to think that they have money spread about elsewhere and aren't just relying on some huge premium bond loot to come. But I think, you know, we are a kind of nation that enjoys that kind of excitement of potentially winning a prize, and you know, being able to withdraw your stake is kind of very attractive to people. It's just that if you are putting all of your eggs in that one basket and not getting interest elsewhere, and you're having barren years like I do on premium bonds, then you're losing money in real terms to inflation. So, it's a fine balance of deciding how you're going to play it and how you're going to do it. And there's lots of people out there that think premium bonds are an absolute nonsense and wouldn't get involved in them whatsoever, which is fair enough. But yeah, I think sometimes in this country we are blessed with choice and we do have options. And this is a quite unique British sort of product. And for that reason, the kind of monthly hope of winning £1 million keeps my money in there, Georgie.
Right. I'm not sure if you watched the Rishi Keir debate the other day, but the Prime Minister was keen to stress that Labour will put up your taxes by £2,000 should they come to power. Now, the Conservatives are positioning themselves as the party of tax cuts. I make no reference to this. This is not a political podcast, as we always say. However, up, down, cut, raise, left, right, Simon is fed up with the political point scoring and has produced his own tax manifesto. So I say this is not a political podcast, but Simon, you are making your pitch right now. The floor is yours, and it will be, I guarantee, far more entertaining than what we had to watch the other night, which I didn't actually watch, by the way. I've got a new puppy, so I have a baby monitor. So I was upstairs listening to it through a baby monitor, which I don't think was any more entertaining than if I'd have been downstairs watching it on the telly. It was a bit muffly.
I
Just
didn't
thought I'd
watch it
share
either.
that with you.
I had something better to do. I can't remember what it was, but I had something better to do.
No.
Right. Now, the
Go,
important thing
Simon.
about this £2,000 figure is that, firstly, it's hotly disputed. It's caused a massive row that has involved pulled in like people from the Treasury who it claimed were responsible for coming up with this figure, and actually they're only responsible for some of it, and then the Tories added a bit on top. It's also not £2,000 a year, it's £2,000 cumulatively. So it adds up over the parliament. However, on the flip side of that, Labour says it's not going to raise your taxes and is very, very, very keen to stress that it will not be raising our taxes. But the cold, hard reality of it is that we spend more money than we have coming in. We used to borrow the gap. Borrowing the gap has got more expensive. Somewhere along the line, something's going to have to give. And politicians of every single one of the main parties are just conveniently ignoring this and making promises to people that somewhere they're going to have to do something in order to meet the promises that they're making. Or we get growth to pick up in this country. We get ourselves back on the up. Instead of being a country of just disdainfully going, oh God, everything is so rubbish and nothing's ever going to get better, we keep waiting for it to get better and it's not going to get better. We pick ourselves up, we get ourselves moving, get the economy going again, and growth picks up. And then all of a sudden, those figures don't look anywhere near as bad as they do. And it is entirely possible to do that. Okay. We don't have to be stuck in this rut. Okay, we need to stop making expensive promises that are even more expensive than the expensive promises we've already made. Think triple lock plus. But we can like pick ourselves up and get growth going. So I just want to say that on a positive note. And I think that a key part of that is restoring faith in the tax system. Completely apolitical here, but you do have to talk about the party that has been in charge for the last 14 years. Over the last 14 years, the Tories have managed to end up with an incoherent tax mess. Now, they inherited a little bit of a tax mess. They didn't create all of this stuff themselves, but they have had quite a long time to fix it. And instead, successive chancellors have just made things worse. Now, before I say this, I should make one very important point, which is actually in the early part of that period, the Tories did something that was very, very good. They raised the personal allowance substantially. Okay, they inherited a quite low personal allowance. That's a tax-free amount you can earn before you pay income tax from the Labour government, and they got it right up. And also, the Cameron government really did lift the higher rate tax threshold at one point. They bumped it all the way up to £50,000. Unfortunately, however, And this comes on to the first point of my manifesto. That's now frozen. So there's a freeze on income tax thresholds, which has combined with high inflation to create a major tax raid. It's dubbed a stealth tax, but it's been done blatantly. I mean, Rishi Sunak started it. Jeremy Hunt stood up and said he was going to do it. And then he said he was going to continue doing it. People long ago started noticing this. And we have a freeze on tax thresholds until 2028. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is not known for its hyperbole, says that this is a colossal stealth tax raid. And just to put some figures on that, it will mean that by 2028, a projected 8.9 million people are paying 40% tax, compared to the 3.2 million that paid it in 2010. Basically, tax thresholds should at least rise with inflation. This is a fundamental part of people feeling that the tax system is fair. Otherwise, even if they're only getting pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which just means that they maintain their standard of living, they're losing out because at the lower stage, more of their income is being dragged into tax. At the upper stage, more of them are being dragged into the 40% tax bracket. And then we move on to the 60% tax trap. We have a top marginal tax rate of 60%, and it's not actually for the highest earners. This is due to the removal of the personal allowance above £100,000. It gets taken away from people at £1. For every £1 earned, they lose 50p of it. What that does is it turns a 40% tax rate into a 60% one. And that 60% tax rate on the next pound earned is paid by those earning between £100,000 and £125,140. Now, every single one of those people is earning a lot of money. Let's be clear, okay? But there is no reason to treat them unfairly. Why would you have a tax system that goes 20%, 40%, 60%, 45%? Why would you have somebody who earns £500,000 a year getting to keep 55% of the next pound they earn, but somebody who earns £110,000 a year only getting to keep 40% of it? It's completely bonkers. It's no way to run a tax system. The Tories actually inherited this one off Labour, but it was brought in during the financial crisis when we were trying to desperately shore up our finances after bailing out the banks. And at no point over the last 14 years have they seen fit to get rid of it. And also, the threshold has remained exactly the same as it was when it was introduced 15 years ago. And if it had gone up just with inflation, it would be £153,000. We should just get rid of this one. Savings tax. Again, good thing the Tories did introduce the personal savings allowance, which means you can earn £1,000 interest tax-free. Not so good because they made it only £500 for higher rate taxpayers and nothing for 45p taxpayers, made it needlessly complicated, but good that they brought it in. Bad that nobody has seen fit to raise the level since then. In the meantime, inflation has soared, interest rates have gone up, many more savers have been pulled into the savings tax net, and this is a sneaky tax raid on the returns from their money. And it also means that throughout that period of high inflation, when savings rates couldn't, even higher savings rates off the back of higher interest rates couldn't match inflation, things were being made worse by tax. I personally think the personal savings allowance should be raised substantially for everyone. I reckon it should be at least £5,000. The tax raid on investors. Jeremy Hunt had the cheek to stand up in his budget and talk about how he was going to boost investors with his British ISA and his Telsid style national NatWest share sale, at the same time as he ploughed ahead with one of the biggest tax raids on personal investors we have seen in many years. He has taken the capital gains tax allowance down from £12,300 to £6,000 and now to £3,000. He's also slashed the dividend tax allowance from £2,000 to £1,000 and now just £500. Now, just to be clear, this is a direct attack on small investors. For the really rich, who are shuffling their income into capital gains or dividends in order to pay less tax rather than taking it as income tax, it's a drop in the ocean. For small investors and pensioners who rely on, you know, their income from investments or selling some of the investments they've got outside of ISAs, it is a massive tax raid. We need to reverse this tax raid and then start moving the allowances up with inflation. And what's made this worse is the fact that there's now stories saying that there's pressure on the Labour Party to increase the capital gains tax rate. So what's going to happen is Rachel Reeves does that, increases the capital gains tax rate, but now you've only got £3,000 allowance. Whereas at least when Jeremy Corbyn was going to come in and increase the capital gains tax rate, you had a £12,000 allowance. Pensions. And now we get on to the thorny issue of pensions. Right. The way that pensions work is you need long-term stability for people to be encouraged to save into them. What you do not need is for the rules to be constantly changing and for people to be leaving comments like, there's no point putting money into your pension, they'll just take it off you at some point in the future, which I see a depressingly large number of in the comments on our articles, particularly as pension saving is massively tax efficient. And also, most people aren't even affected by some of these limits. But what is not helping the situation is that Jeremy Hunt got rid of the pension lifetime allowance, which, let it be said, was a good move. Now, the pension lifetime allowance was introduced by Gordon Brown in April 2006 at 1.5 million, when Labour left power, it was 1.8 million. The Tories managed to massively compound the issue by hacking the lifetime allowance all the way down to 1 million before raising it ever so slightly to 1.073. At which point, it caused so many problems and was starting to cause ructions in the NHS that Jeremy Hunt axed it. Helpfully, Rachel Reeves then immediately said that she would bring it back, but has refused to give any more details whatsoever. Will she bring it back at 1.07 million? Will she bring it back at the 1.8 million Labour left it at? Would she uprate that 1.8 million that Labour left it at to the 2.5 million that would be worth today? Because that would be fair enough. This was targeted at much richer people than it has been catching. But oh no, she said that over a year ago, hasn't been drawn on it. Nobody knows anything since. In the meantime, it's been removed. Pension savers who are in that position of going, what do I do? Do I take money out? Do I rush to take money out? What do I do? It's limiting the amount of money going in because people are worried it's going to come back. But also it's an example of the kind of meddling and muddled thinking that means we don't have clarity and damages faith in the pension system. So there's now talk of, are they going to raise a pension tax relief? Are they going to find a way to create a wealth tax that somehow acts on pensions? It's like, probably none of these things are going to happen, but there's always the chatter about it. We need every single one of the political parties to give us a clear path for pensions, from pension tax relief to the lifetime allowance, and then commit to leaving everything alone for a very long time. There are many other things that we need to do, but this is just a start at trying to restore faith in our tax system, because we need to treat people fairly on tax, because then they are more willing to pay their fair share.
Well, I'd vote for you, Simon. That's it for part one.
I'm joined today for our weekly Investing Explained feature by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me.
We've got to read a question here, and hopefully you can answer it. Do I have to invest the money that I pay into my SIP straight away?
So the short answer is no. Money in your SIP can sit in cash if you don't feel like the market conditions are right for you to invest right now, if you feel like it's volatile or expensive perhaps. But it's worth considering investing in your pension is a long-term strategy, and you should consider making regular contributions and investing regularly. So if you do feel as though the timing is not right, there are methods to navigate this. Pound cost averaging being the main one, which is essentially drip feed investing, just helps to average out the price at which you buy your investments.
And is there a risk of leaving money uninvested in accounts for too long? I would imagine that there are people who pay money into their pensions and then don't invest it for maybe, you know, a year or something.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So there isn't a risk in the sense that the nominal value of the money will change, but there are risks to consider in terms of investment accounts and SIPs aren't necessarily designed to hold cash, so they generally won't offer the same rate of return as a cash savings account, for example. And if the rate of interest you're earning is less than inflation, then the value of your money is diminishing over time, what we call diminishing the value of its purchasing power. So there is that risk, that inflation risk, and there's also the opportunity cost to consider, missing out on the potential growth that has the ability to then compound over a long time frame.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Following on from our recent discussions about firing and chilling, retiring early, you have a reader question from someone who doesn't want to retire outright in their 50s, but would like to stop working full time by the age of 54. They are 44 now. Due to pay off their mortgage in 8 years, by which stage youngest of three kids will be 19, probably left home, etc. And they aren't financially doing too badly at the moment, but is what they have enough? So, Lee, take up the story. How much do they have? How much do they need?
This is part of our new regular financial planning series where we're getting readers to write in with their sort of questions, and we're getting financial experts, IFAs, the like, to respond on, you know, almost like a health check on your finances and where you could improve potentially, and whether you're on track for the kind of retirement and life that you want in the future. Now, the thing that struck me about this reader question is the person who has written in here is in their mid-40s, and they've got themselves into a very, very good position. And I would urge people that are listening to this to go and have a read of this question, because sometimes these ones are a little bit tricky to completely explain on the podcast. But it is well worth pointing out here that 150k in a stocks and shares ISA, 30k in cash savings, wife has 50k in cash savings, £30,000 invested in shares, work pensions at 300 grand with £1,500 a month going in between himself and employer, 17k in a SIP, £60,000 in a SIP for self-employed wife, and she's also paying into a pension. So you're already seeing here that they've set, I would call that the foundations, the very, very strong foundations to what should set you up for a very good retirement. Now, what this person is asking is that they kind of want to retire in their mid-50s, which I think is a kind of dream for a lot of people. If you're in a kind of very healthy, happy marriage and relationship, I think that you kind of having a plan like this is very noble, because, you know, your children, if you have children, are potentially moving out, going to university, you know, going and living their life. But it's almost like, I think there's quite a big trend of this, and we did touch on it on the Chill podcast a little while back, about people that are kind of, you know, getting to that age, and they almost want to, not, I'm not going to say like relive their youth, but kind of like they're still youthful enough to go and enjoy things like going on nice holidays, going to tick off the bucket list stuff that potentially you never got around to doing before you had children. And I'm already doing this now. I have a 5-year-old and a 7-week-year-old, and I'm saying to myself, there are just certain trips that I know now that I will not take until my youngest is 18. And that pushes me into 50s, you know, and that's like the bucket list trip to Japan. You know, I just can't imagine taking the children there. It may be when they're teenagers, but, you know, I think there's a lot of that kind of thing where it's, you kind of make the sacrifices for having children, but while you're doing that, and if you are both working or one of you is working and you're diligently sticking money away, there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't potentially retire in your mid-50s. Now, you can only access some of your private pension, and that's going to be at 58. So there's that to factor in. Other factors here, of course, we've not even talked about the potential of them both qualifying for a full state pension that will hopefully supplement your private pension and income from elsewhere, i.e. getting a return from your stocks and shares ISA, and hopefully living off the compound interest of that each year, which is again a very good thing to have on the radar. Now, both of the experts here said that going by the sums and figures involved, in a mid-60s, by the mid-60s, they should have around about £800,000 to £850,000 in investments and pensions. That should give you a pretty comfortable lifestyle. But what you've got to remember is we're living longer, for one. The cost of care, if you have to go down that route later in life, is incredibly expensive. At the moment, I can't foresee a way in which care costs are going to become any lower. There doesn't really seem to be a plan. I'm not sure what the plan is as we all age. I can't think about it too much. And then actually assuming here that they're going to be spending £60,000 a year after stopping traditional work at 54. I mean, that's a fair whack of money. But you think about, you know, if you are taking those luxury trips and you are doing those things, I mean, it's very unlikely that in your mid-50s that you're going to be backpacking in hostels. I'm not saying that some people don't do that, but you're probably used to a bit of life of luxury and spending those kind of money, but that kind of money. But I think this whole case study, I read it and I felt attuned to it. I kind of like, you know, I kind of aspire to be the
speaking to you, was it, Lee?
Yeah, it was. And I was thinking, you know, potentially in, you know, 10 years time, when I'm going to be sort of in my mid-40s, And I kind of was like, it'd be nice to have a similar level. That's what I'm building towards. I don't have a full target of what I'm investing towards in terms of sums and pension and things, but I like to think that I'm on track. And I think this is what this financial plan thing is really good for. Lots of people are writing in and they are kind of on track, but there are sort of little ways that they might be able to boost it even further. But then there's also some people that feel like they're a bit behind, and what can they do? And it's been hugely successful. People have been really enjoying this series. It's been written by one of our newer reporters, Harvey Dorset.
Very good. Well, I was going to say, Simon, what about us who will not be in our mid-40s in 10 years' time, because we might be closer to it than that and we're not quite on target? Should we just look at this article and then panic and give up?
No, but you do have to be realistic and work on the basis that if you were thinking of this kind of semi-retirement, say semi-retirement, but it's really not semi-retirement, is it? And this goes back to what we were talking about on the podcast the other week. It's more about working on your own terms. It's about not having to do the 8 till 7, 5 days a week. So I think that you have to be realistic and say, well, actually, if I haven't built up a pot and there is no opportunity for me to start building up the pot, then I can't do that. But could I build up the pot? And then it's like, what can I use to bridge the gaps? And I think what's really interesting about this is saying, I'm going to continue working. Both of us could do some work, but we don't want to work full time. And we reckon that between the two of us in today's money, we could bring in £30,000 a year, right? So, and we think we would need £60,000 a year in today's money to spend. So it's saying, okay, we don't have enough money. We've not done the FIRE thing, right, that we were talking about the other week. And we're not going to be able to just stop working, total financial independence. But what we could do is do some work, and £30,000 a year between the two of us. Then we need another £30,000 a year to meet the £60,000 worth of saving, so £60,000 worth of spending. Is that achievable? And, you know, as the answer here, which, you know, is quite a lot of detail goes into, yes, that is achievable. It's possible. It's not guaranteed, but it is achievable. And those two things are, you have to really like draw the line between those two things, guaranteed and achievable. And if you look at what those investments, so £180,000 in total investments, let's set aside the cash that we're talking about here. If you get a 6% average return over the next 10 years, which is possible, okay, it's not guaranteed again, but it's achievable, then that would grow to £327,000. But if you can get £600 a month added to that, you invest an extra £600 a month between the two of you for the next 10 years, then you get up to £426,000. And if you look at needing £30,000 a year, and you need that £30,000 a year to be coming from those investments for at least 4 years, the gap between taking that semi-retirement, working on your own terms, whatever you want to call it, at 54, and when you can start accessing your work pensions at 58. So you've got that gap, okay? So £30,000 over 4 years, you take out £120,000. Well, you'd still have £300,000 in the pot, even if there was no investment growth whatsoever. So that's not too bad to still have the £300,000 at 58, which you're then going to need to draw on potentially to top up the money that you're getting from your work pensions, because you're not going to get your state pension until you're 58. But if you go back to that £426,000 that you might have in an ISA, firstly, great thing is if you've got it in an ISA, you can take the money tax-free, so you don't need to worry about tax on it, okay? That's a really important thing. Secondly, if you withdrew it, if you could get a natural income of 4% on that, which is entirely achievable, again, not guaranteed, but achievable, you know, a selection of income investment trusts would do it for you, get you 4% a year, that would be £17,000. So that would just be taking the income. So you'd only be needing to take £13,000 a year from the capital. And then it starts to look more achievable. And then you go, okay, well, what about the bit from 58 to 68? Well, you're going to have to cover that with no state pension, but maybe you can draw a bit more on that ISA over those years there. You know, try to not take too much from your pension, because you know that at 68, you're going to get the state pension. And in today's money, again, that'd be worth £11,500 each. That's £23,000. It's £23,000 of your £60,000 a year projected spending. You start to map all this stuff out and you realise that, yes, actually, potentially it is achievable.
Well, there you go. That is good news. Right. I'm going to move on, Simon, because the transition to fully electric vehicles has hit a few bumps in the road of late, as the proportion of battery electric vehicles sold in the UK car market has shrunk. But it seems that drivers aren't just a bit bothered with the new ones, they're also not particularly taken with second-hand EVs either. And the biggest worry is the battery. Simon, look, what's been going on with EVs of late?
There's a couple of things that have been going on with EVs of late. And what needs to be taken into account is that there is something within the tax system at play that has been depleting used car prices on EVs. So many employers offer a salary sacrifice scheme whereby you can buy a new electric car on a monthly finance PCP deal and you can salary sacrifice it. Now, you're not buying it. There's you have to pay the amount at the end of the 3 years or 4 years or whatever to take ownership of the car. But basically, you pay a certain amount every month for the car. If you salary sacrifice that amount, you have to pay a small benefit in kind charge, which claws back a little bit of it. But because electric cars are seen as a good thing, there's hardly any benefit in kind charge there. And what this effectively means is that if you are a higher rate taxpayer, you're saving 42% a month on those monthly PCP payments because you would otherwise be paying tax on that money. So the actual cost to you of paying, for example, £800 is only £500, right? And because you save the income tax and the national insurance. Now, if you then look at the used car market, where somebody could go out and buy a used electric car, the depreciation on the used electric car would probably mean that, you know, in normal circumstances, the monthly cost of buying the used car, the three-year-old car, was about £500. People are looking at this and saying, why would I buy a three-year-old used electric car for £500 where there's no tax benefit whatsoever, when I work it out with the salary sacrifice calculator, I could pay pretty much the same amount and get a brand new one with all of the costs of the ownership rolled into it. The obvious impact here is on used electric car prices because people aren't buying them because they could just get a new one instead. So that has depressed used electric car prices. Then you go further down the scale into like cheaper electric cars, because the problem with used electric cars is most of them aren't that old. So they're quite expensive and they started off quite expensive in the first place. So even with all that depreciation, they're still pretty expensive. I mean, you can get an I-PACE now for £17,000-£18,000, which is a massive depreciation on its cost new. But you're looking at maybe a 4 or 5 year old car. What there is a shortage of, and we had a story on this week, is cheap used electric cars, the ones below £15,000. And this is mass market used car territory where lots of people buy, you know, relatively cheap cars. There's a huge amount of turnover in cars that cost less than £10,000, for example. Once you get down to the £10,000 used electric cars, you don't necessarily have the same impact from that salary sacrifice pushing down the costs. You've got a bit of a trickle down, but not so much. But you also start to get into the territory where the battery guarantees are running out of life. And the electric car manufacturers put really quite long guarantees on their batteries, but you might be running towards the end of it. And the cost of replacing the battery would be very, very expensive. All of the evidence, however, is showing that the batteries are lasting longer than thought. And it's not like the battery just goes kaput. It just doesn't give you as much range from the full charge. It starts to wear down. Think of it like the battery in your phone, except electric car batteries, the evidence suggests, are lasting much better than the battery in your phone. There are ways of killing it and making sure that it runs down much faster, just as you can do with your phone, you know, that kind of like randomly charging it all the time when you don't need to thing. But people are less likely to do that with their cars because they can't just plug it in the office or on the side in the kitchen, things like that. So it's maybe not as much of a concern as it needs to be. But if you're going to go spend £8,000 on a car, then you are probably going to worry about this a bit. And it's a new technology to you and you don't really know about it, because the alternative is you could just go spend £8,000 on a petrol car.
Lee, what are your views on EVs? I mean, bearing in mind, you certainly can't charge your car on your kitchen surface unless you have an enormous kitchen surface. But actually, a lot of people can't even charge their car outside their home because they don't have access. Would you go for one, Lee? Have you gone for one? Sorry, I should have asked that one first.
I haven't gone for one. No, I've still got a petrol car. I'm not quite ready for the move over to electric quite yet, mainly because when we bought our car, I had a view of holding it for a certain amount of years. So I'm not in the market. I'm not one of those to keep up with the Joneses. I'd rather have a car and have it for a long time and use it and use it and use it, because it's just another decision to make that I just can't be bothered to make in life when there's so many decisions already. But I think, you know, if you're in the market for a new car and you're not sure whether you should go electric or whether you should stick with petrol or whatever kind of method you want, you know, I think it's, you got to do your homework. You've got to go and find out if it's right for you. I think that if you are in a house with a driveway, you know, how much is it going to cost for you to get an installation point, and how long will it take for you to get it? What options are there out there? I mean, some are saying, you know, that Auto Trader data is quite damning, really, isn't it? That there's only 10,000 secondhand EVs for sale for under 15 grand when there's 350,000 petrol diesel equivalents for that same price point. That's massive. And I think lots of people are a little bit nervy of the used EV market, because it is a very, let's not forget this, it's still quite in its infancy, you know, in terms of the technology. Things have improved vastly, but I think a lot of people that are going into potentially thinking about buying an electric car in the used market, I think there's a bit of nervousness. And I think the nervousness really stems from batteries. I think that's what people are kind of most nervy about. I don't think it's really kind of like the range anxiety stuff. I think that's kind of going out the window now. I think the range on these cars are at a level where I'm not sure it's as much of a discussion. I think it's more people are kind of like, are these cars actually greener? Now, one story that was out this week from Rob Harwell, Motoring Reporter, that I thought was really super interesting, actually, is this idea of having a battery passport. Now, what that means is every manufacturer is meant to be having these come in by 2027. Volvo's already doing it. And what these battery passports show are the carbon footprint of the how it's made, the origin of materials, the composition, and I think the most important part, the end of life treatment. Because I think there's this kind of thought process of, where are these batteries going? How are they being recycled? You know, how long do they last? How much is it going to cost to replace? Those kind of questions, I think, are now more at the forefront than something like range anxiety. So yeah, I mean, as I say, if you are interested and you are in a point now where you need a new car, I would say don't rule it out at all. You know, don't go in with a mindset of I'm not buying an electric car, it's all nonsense. I think you've got to go and have a look and do your own research and do your own homework, and if at the end of it you come away and end up buying another petrol car, you know, so be it. That's my viewpoint. You know, it's personal choice. It's up to you. If it's getting you from A to B in a, you know, a kind of reasonable price point that's within your budget and you're not overstretching yourself, I think you go for what suits you best.
Simon, just a quick one. I did a podcast recently about electric vehicles and the future of electric vehicles and that sort of thing. And the person I was speaking to was very bullish about it. What are your thoughts? I mean, the road ahead is bumpy, but we have all these sort of issues with US and China and people questioning, is this just sort of beta technology? What is your view of the future of EVs? Is the technology right?
The technology is excellent. The technology is very good. The technology is getting better all of the time. Range is beyond what most people would drive in a week, let alone a single journey. It is an issue if you're driving long journeys and you have to rely on public charging, but it's only an issue on the occasions that you drive the long journeys. And if you're someone who's racking up 40,000 miles a year, maybe don't go for it, although that would massively increase the savings that you could get. Once you start to combine it with things like having solar panels at home, having agile energy tariffs and so on, then it's really good. I do think that the headlong rush into pushing people towards electric cars and demonizing diesel is potentially environmentally damaging, because actually, you know, once you get over the air quality issues that were raised by the VW Dieselgate thing, okay, if you know that's not affecting every diesel car, actually, and modern diesel cars don't have that problem. They're not cheating the system anymore, because surely no car maker is going to be that dumb to do that again. Then what we've done is we've seen a backlash against diesel and people move to petrol cars instead, which are less efficient, more damaging for the environment. And so we're causing more damage to the environment by this, at the same time as you cannot ignore the environmental cost of building a car. I think that's really important. There are some studies that go into the total environmental cost of cars, but, you know, all these electric cars have, you know, minerals going into them that have to be mined. Now, that environmental cost might not be in this country, but it's certainly in another country. And, you know, the environmental cost of getting that stuff out of the ground, just the environmental cost of building a new car. I'm personally a fan of used cars and running used cars for as long as you possibly can, because that car has already been made and the environmental cost of making it has been sunk many, many years ago. You know, our family car is 11 years old. You know, I've got another car that's 2006. So what's that? It's nearly 20 years old now, 18 years old, you know, and I've got an old classic car that's like a 1991 car as well. But so, you know, the environmental cost of making those cars was sunk years ago. So I think there's pros and there's cons. Now, the one thing I would say is that when you're looking at some of these cheap electric cars, especially the used ones that are quite cheap now, is you should factor in the fact that the running costs can be really, really super low. So if you have a smart charging system, so basically you sign up to a smart charger and to some form of agile energy deal, which means that you charge your car at the times when it's cheapest possible to do so, so non-peak times, then you could get the cost of doing 1,000 miles a month in a Vauxhall Corsa down to £18.
Oh.
Yeah. That's really not a lot. Now, the cost of doing that in a petrol Corsa would be £128 a month. So wow, that's a saving of over £1,300 wow, a year. Now, the problem is, if you want to buy yourself that Vauxhall Corsa, well, the petrol one starts at £18,000 and the electric one starts at £26,000. However, take that and then go look at a 2015 plate Renault Zoe. You can get a good condition 2015 plate Renault Zoe with 32,000 miles on the clock for £6,300. If you want a good condition 2015 Renault Clio with about 30,000 miles on the clock, it will cost you the same as that or slightly more. Now, if you can run that Renault Zoe for £18 a month, versus running that Renault Clio for £130 a month, all of a sudden you can see quite substantial savings. And, you know, maybe don't even go for the agile energy tariff thing and the smart charger, go for the solar panels as well. And then you start to see where you can really get the cost down and actually really start to benefit the environment by using green energy instead of using energy that's been produced potentially somewhere in a power station that's not great for the environment.
Fabulous. Simon, thank you very much for that. All right, finally, new banknotes which carry the portrait of King Charles III came out this week. And they're already being listed by chances on eBay, Lee, for as much as 150 quid. Wow. I mean, are they worth it? Which one should be looking out for? We're going to talk serial numbers, Lee. This is your moment.
This is money.
The money actually, man, boys, go
this,
for
this,
it.
This is money, isn't money. It? This is actual money.
Yeah.
This is great, Georgie. I'll take you back. I'll really speed you through this one, right? So back in 2016, when the new £5 notes were launched, the polymer notes with Churchill, we kind of accidentally became the kind of forefront of getting people to check serial numbers in your change at the pub, in the shops, whatever, looking out for the AA01 prefix. it snowballed out of control. The stories we wrote about it went absolutely bonkers.
Yep.
It was a crazy few months.
You became famously.
I was the face mobbed in the street. I was the face of the note craze. Yeah, what a great thing to have on my journalism CV. But look, it was fun. It was fun for a while, and then it all died down and whatever. There was a Bank of England charity auction where I think it all really kicked off, and the note number 17 went for £4,150. I mean, it was just absolutely crazy times. Now we are in a newer era of notes, and this is only the second person to feature, you know, a monarch to feature on our notes after Queen Elizabeth, so it's quite a big deal. So we've got King Charles notes that came out this week. Now, our savings and banking reporter, Helen Crane, got the info from the Bank of England. We had a shot in the dark. I really didn't think they would give us this information, but we asked what the first printed notes, what the prefixes would be of the first ones to come off the presses. Now, the reason why we asked that question is because they are probably the notes that are worth keeping an eye out for. And keeping hold of, crucially keeping them in good condition. Don't crumple them up in jean pockets or in wallets or anything like that. So for each four denominations, I've got the info here for you. Okay, so if you get a new £5 note in your change, you're looking for the first four digits, the prefix CCA01, £10 HB01, £20 EH01, and £50 note. If you're getting £50 notes, then wow, okay, you're doing well. AJ01. They are the prefixes to be looking out for. Now, the Bank of England cannot confirm to us whether these are out in the wild already yet. There are Charles £10 notes that are out in the wild, but we just don't know whether these prefixes are out there or not. But that hasn't stopped people on eBay listing their new King Charles notes with just random serial numbers that aren't any of these four codes on them. And we're talking sold prices here. They're going for roughly triple face value. £10 note, I saw there was one that went for sort of 25 quid, something like that. Collectors love to get their hands on this stuff, like early days. But really, it's going to be these serial numbered notes that you're going to want to look out for. Now, the Bank of England is also doing another charity auction of these notes in the coming weeks and months. Number one, so for example, £5 note CA01000001 goes to the King. And the same for each of the banknotes. And lots of these low numbers would have gone to sort of Bank of England staff, people that are in the design process, that kind of thing. The charity auction is the opportunity to get the very lowest serial numbered first minted notes, first printed notes. You're not really going to find that low. You might strike it lucky in your change, but it's worth a look, Georgie. It is worth a look. I would say the only ones that are really worth looking out for are the four prefixes that I mentioned. Yeah. And there's 999,000 of each of those prefixes. The lower number you get from that six digits at the end, or if you get rounded numbers, or you get numbers that are popular with overseas buyers, so something that ends in a 7 or an 8 perhaps for the Chinese market. There's a lot to it, but I would, lots of these notes. We actually got some exclusive research. I love this. Got some exclusive research from the Building Society, and said that they asked 2,000 people, and 15% said that they will hold on to new notes when they get their hands on them to sell on eBay or an auction, especially if they have an early serial number, which I think is just, you know, it shows you that people are kind of wise to this and will hoover them out.
It's your fault, Lee. It's your fault.
People have done this crazy. You know, it's a bit of fun, isn't it? And actually, you know what, I bang the drum, you know, constantly about physical money, and, you know, we're in an era in which, you know, we are using contactless payments more. We are using digital transactions more, and the use of physical cash has kind of fizzled a bit. If this is an excuse for people to go out and get some cash out of the cash machine and spend a bit of actual money around the local economy, then I'm all for it. It's like a treasure hunt of, you know, like the treasure hunt is like the Kew Gardens 50p coin, right? Only 210,000 of those minted. They sell for a lot of money online. you are probably never going to find one of those in your change now. They've all been hoovered out, pretty much. You might be very, very, very lucky, but it's very unlikely. This is like a new version of that. You know, there are way more, 999,000 of them, but, you know, you want to keep your eyes out for those first. I never found an AA015 pound note, for example. So you think, well, there's almost a million of them, but honestly, it's still kind of needle in a haystack kind of territory. And as I say, anything that kind of gets people out spending money, potentially getting banknotes because they want to find one of these, then I'm all for it, Georgie.
I was going to say, I want to do a little competition. Who can get their hands on, not even one of these numbers that you say, but just a new note with King Charles's head on? Because I'll be honest with you, Lee, I think I'll be last because I don't even know. I don't know when I get the cash out.
I'm going to go up to the high street, my local high street, in a minute, actually, because I've got to go and...
it's always going to be you to win.
I'm going to renew my passport, so I might go to a couple of different cash machines and see what I can find.
Honestly,
I'll keep you posted, Georgie.
I honestly can't wait.
It's exciting.
But I have to tell you, dear listener, I wish you could have seen Lee during that little segment there. I mean, he was right up to the microphone. The arm was up. He was really going for it. Lee, you get excited by this stuff, don't you? Look,
in all seriousness, you know, we are This Is Money. And I feel
This is money.
I feel like this is the very essence, you know, we've got to be representing. And I think that you will find, if you go back over the archives of all of our note and coin content over the last 10 years or so, we do things differently. You know, this wasn't exclusive. We were straight on this, and we always report things very accurately. There's no kind of like inflation of, oh, I've got a 50p coin, is it worth £5,000? Yeah. Let's find this 50p coin, it's worth £5,000. No, it's no frills. People go, I still get emails now, I've got this 50p Benjamin Britten coin or a Lord Kitchener coin, you know, what's it worth? And I'm like, it's worth 50p. You know, it's not, and then, you know, there are some rare
brain on their parade there, Lee.
There's very few that are worth actual good money. You know, Kew Gardens is a real kind of extreme example. Some of the other examples of worth plucking out your change if you find them are things like the A to Z 10p coins. They can be worth a tidy bit of cash. And some of the kind of sort of Peter Rabbit coin, 50p coins, and things like that, that, you know, people are looking to finish off their collections, you know, can be worth a little bit more, but they're never going to be worth life-changing sums of money. It's just a bit of fun, in my mind. But, you know, if you do manage to get a £10 note, for example, that has got HB01, and you get hold of that in the next couple of months and you list that on eBay, it is not just a UK thing, Georgie. It's very popular worldwide. In Americans, Chinese, they really do like British notes and currency. Right. And we'll get involved as well. So we're in a global time, we're in a global market. You know, you will probably make way more than £10 off that £10. It will be worth more than face value. We've got experts in this story that are saying the same thing. People from Spinks, people from individual valuation companies that are saying it is well worth having these notes. It's a very new market, so we don't know kind of how much they would sell for. But I'd imagine that an HB01 £10 note would have a lot of interest in it.
Right. Thank you very much, Lee. That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor at thisismoney.
This is money.
editor at thisismoney.co.uk. And you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all This Is Money podcasts past and join the debate in reader comments.
Marvellous. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I've spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.